Hey, that song is really connected to what we're talking about today because, you know, that whole idea of don't look inside, that's where the demons hide. You know, there are things that live inside of us that have this innate ability to subtly or not so subtly just begin to take over our lives. Well, hey, really excited you're here this morning. My name's Kurt. If we haven't had a chance to meet, it's great to meet you and have you here at Cross Point. And as we've said throughout the morning, you know, we realize there's so many places you could be, and we really consider it a privilege if you're here for the first time, or if you're here every week and you're back again. So we are wrapping up the series, Slaying Giants, today, and this series has been really cool because of just the things it's been revealing in our lives and the growth that many of us have been having and the revelations many of us have been having. And this really began back in the spring when a number of men here at CrossFit went through this thing called Fight Club, and we had to read this book called Goliath Must Fall by Louis Giglio. And so it was so powerful in the men who went through this experience, uncovering some of the giants, that we decided to turn it into a series. So a lot of what we're doing is coming from the book, and you can purchase that and pick it up if you really dig it. So today we're going to be taking a look at the giant of addiction. And, you know, you just mention the word addict or addiction, and immediately the temperature and the atmosphere in the room changes. Because immediately our mind goes to things like alcohol and porn and, you know, narcotics. And we're like, oh, you know, an addict. I mean, addicts go to rehab. I mean, I'm not an addict. And yeah, one of the things I want us to see this morning is that we're all vulnerable on this front. All right? Addiction can come in many shapes and forms. And so we're going to look beyond just the big ones, and I certainly don't want to demean the process of addressing a major addiction in our life, but at the same time, I don't want any of us to just sit here and go, oh, well, that's not me. I mean, I don't deal with addiction. Here's the big idea for today. An addiction is anything we can't live without. Anything we can't live without. I want you to think for a moment. Is there anything in my life that I just can't live without? And, you know, is there anything that I don't even think about, but if you were to remove it from my life, I'd be like, oh my gosh, I don't know that I can live without that. I mean, maybe it's a caffeine crave, or, you know, some energy drink that just keeps you always going, or maybe it's a shopping habit, or, you know, that you always have to have things going on. I mean, it's like, I can't pause. I'm always looking for the next hit, the next adrenaline rush, because I'm afraid of what might happen if I have to sit and reflect. And so, you know, anything that we can't do without is considered an addiction. And so I want us to see today, addictions come in many shapes, sizes, and forms. And there's nothing, no way better to look at this than to go to Sheldon from the Big Bang Theory. He helps us understand what this looks like.
Maybe we should break for lunch. What time is it?
According to the world's worst cuckoo clock, it's 2.
And I'm more tired than ever.
Why don't you just go home?
No, I can do this. I just need another energy drink. Oh, no.
What?
I want another one.
So?
That's a craving. That's a sign of chemical dependency.
I only had one.
No, I know, but plenty of things are addictive after a single exposure. We crack cocaine, nicotine, Pringles. You know, once one pops, one just can't stop.
You can't develop a problem that fast.
You want to bet? Oh, great, now I'm addicted to gambling.
We can't afford to lose any more time.
Well, this probably won't work, but has anyone ever tried to just haul off and whoop the crazy out of him?
That's not helpful. It's fun to think about, but it's not helpful. Hey, Sheldon, we are on a serious time crunch. We can't do this without you. Can you please pull it together?
I'm sorry. Yes, of course.
Thank you.
You should please bear with me if I display symptoms of caffeine withdrawal.
No worries.
You guys stink. I was thinking that the best way to fight my addiction is by weaning myself off in steps. Now, I couldn't find a caffeine patch, but I did find what claims to be a mind-boosting caffeine suppository. Now, you know, there's an interesting fact about the rectum.
Sheldon! We are dealing with an impossible deadline from the Air Force because of you. So have an energy drink, don't have an energy drink. Order suppositories and shove them wherever you want, I don't care.
You don't shove them, they come with an Easy Glide applicator.
Oh, man. You know, addiction's come in any way, shape, or size, right? I mean, we constantly are going after that thing that brings relief. In fact, we are known today as one of the most overstimulated and over-addicted generations that's ever lived in the history of time. In fact, Tim Elmore, he actually shares about this in his recent blog post on growingleaders.com. Here's what he says. He says, recently, two investors in Apple Inc. wrote a letter to the company seeking CEO Tim Cook and his executive team to do something about iPhone addictions. They said, Apple can play a defining role in signaling to the industry that paying special attention to the health and the development of the next generation is both good business and the right thing to do, wrote billion-dollar investors Jana Partners and the California State Teachers Retirement System. And then he went on to talk about how NBC News analyst wrote this. He said, there is a developing consensus around the world, including Silicon Valley, that the potential long-term consequences of new technologies need to be factored in at the outset, and no company can outsource that responsibility. What are they saying right here? You know what they're saying is we are creating addicts. We're creating addicts. And again, an addiction is when we have anything that we can't live without. And so, you know, think about that question. What is it in my life that I just couldn't go a day without? And sometimes people say, well, I mean, I don't have an addiction there. And I'll say, okay, we'll go the next 30 days without it. Oh, well, I don't know that I could do that. You know, anything that has control in our life, anything we're tethered to, you know, any device that we can't live without it in our hand day after day, you know, a habit we can't break, a person that we can't separate from, a pattern in our life that, you know, we know it's harmful and yet we keep coming back to it. I mean, you know, that we can't get through the evening without a beverage to take the edge off. I mean, if there's anything in our pattern of life that we say, well, I can't make it through without this, then maybe that's got a hold on us. And these things subtly kind of creep into our life, and sometimes not so subtly creep into our life, and they begin to change us, and we begin to live out of a false identity, and it affects us, and it affects everyone around us. This is the power of addiction. And so the substance may be different. I mean, the substance has changed, but you know, the pattern is the same. And when we self-medicate, that's what addiction is. It's a self-medication. And for some people, their drug of choice is some kind of drug. It's alcohol, it's cocaine, it's some drug that makes me just feel good. I'm like, oh, it's not that damaging, but it lets me like have fun all night long. You know, for some of us, it's caffeine, sugar. For others, it's that we're addicted to money. I mean, it's like it doesn't matter how much we have, we always need more. For others, it's, you know, endless addictions to sex in any way, shape, or form. And what's interesting is sex and money actually have a lot in common with each other. See, money is interesting because money is this thing where, like, I wonder how little I can give away and not make God mad at me. All right? And sex is like, I wonder how far I can go without God getting mad at me. And so it's interesting, we use money and sex on the opposite ends of the continuum, and yet the interesting thing there is we're worried about God being mad. Maybe God says something about these things because it's not about him being angry, it's about what he knows is best for our lives when we live certain ways. See, porn has a huge hold on our culture. 40 million people visit a porn site in the United States every single month. 70% of them are men between ages of 18 and 24. 1 in 3 are women. You know, porn tells us the lie that I will never get out of this addiction, and yet that's not true. For some of you, it's something as simple as buying things. You know, it's like my coping mechanism when life gets hard is I need to go somewhere and have a shopping cart in front of me. And it doesn't matter your socioeconomic, you know, status. It doesn't matter if you have money or not. You know, you just can't help yourself. And so for some, the drug is Nordstrom. For others, it's Target. For some, it's Amazon. Why do you think we have 24-hour stores that are open all the time? It's because people in the middle of the night, when they can't cope with something, they actually feel better, get this, by having a shopping cart in front of them and pushing it through the store and filling it with things. It's called retail therapy. But if we're honest, we could say it's a drug. All right? For others of us, it's accomplishments. I know this is a struggle for me. You know, this always seeking new levels of achievement, always trying to go to new territory, and there's a part of that that's healthy, but if it's just to create the hit or to create validation, it becomes a drug. You know, it's approvals. It's you know, it even starts back in like elementary school when we bring home straight A's, and then all of a sudden you go to junior high and you're in advanced placement because 4.0, which I would have been really happy with, by the way, wasn't enough, so it's like, I got to get a 4.2 GPA. Or it's on the sports field where we constantly have to be the best. It's not that we bring our best. We have to be the best. And if we're not the best, we don't know how to cope. And we write it off. And we say, oh, that's developing us as people, or it's developing our kids. But deep down, we know that that's a drug that we continue to subscribe to. I mean, adrenaline can be a drug. That need for a constant hit, to constantly have an energy drink in our hand, to constantly be caffeinated. I mean, this is something for me a few years ago. I realized, man, caffeine had a major hold on my life. If I didn't have a coffee by 9:30, I was in a fog all day. And so I've reduced to where I have one cup and decaf the rest of the day because it had a hold in my life. You know, we get addicted to people, and that's an interesting one. But some of us, we can't live if we don't have a certain person around us all the time. Or we're always on our phone waiting for the text from him or her. Why didn't she text me? Why didn't he text me? Why haven't I heard from him? It's been 30 minutes. What are they doing? Why? And we're and you're like here this morning, and you're looking at me, and you're listening to me. But every couple, you know, minutes, you're like looking at your phone. Or the Apple Watch or, you know, Android version is really helpful, right? Because, you know, you're like, I don't have a device in my hand. You just do this the whole time. Oh, I wonder why she hasn't texted me. I wonder why when is he going to text me? And so we have this constant addiction to be connected. Social media. You know, social media can be an addiction. And I mean, think about it. For many of us, the first thing we look at in the morning is social media. It's the first thing we touch. The last thing we fondle before we go to bed is our screen, our social media account. And it's not just we're addicted to social media, but we're really addicted to something deeper, which is what other people think. And I like social media, at least I think I do. I'm beginning to convince myself that maybe I don't. I love staying connected. I love, you know, being able to be connected to people I'm not in proximity with, whether it's family or friends. I love being able to share life with other people, which is the healthy part of it. But it can be harmful, too. I mean, you may have had a moment like I had recently when we were in Africa. We didn't have much connection, you know, to the web or to cell service, and every now and then we would. And so we were asked to come up with a phrase that kind of captured our trip and share that with the group that we were with. And so I kind of typed it into my phone, and I thought, oh, this would be cool to share, and put a few pictures that had something to do with how the joy of these kids we were experiencing. They were so joyful, and how I felt so poor in spirit because they had nothing, literally nothing, and yet there was a joy in their life. And I look around my life, and I'm like, I have like what seems like everything, and yet my day doesn't go well, and I just feel down in the dumps, and yet these kids, man, the joy through their lives was just, it was contagious. And so I posted something about that. And then I went to check email, and all of a sudden a banner came up, and it said, you have one new like. I'm like, oh, somebody saw that. And then all of a sudden another new like came up, and I hit that. I'm like, oh, I wonder who liked my photo. Because, you know, we post something, then what do? We wait for the magic like button, right? So I'm looking at the post, and all of a sudden it's like, ding, 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 five new likes. And so before long, I'd be looking back at my email, and then I'd go back and I'd refresh the screen. I wonder who likes me now, and I'd be back at my email, and I'd be back at the screen. And all of a sudden the likes stopped. I'm like, oh my gosh, I guess they forgot about me. And then I realized it was 2 a.m. back in the States. That's why nobody's responding. But see, this is how the power of addiction works. It sucks us in. It sucks us in. Now, Giglio, in his book, Louis Giglio, he says this, even about social media. He says, social media is used to connect us with people we otherwise wouldn't see or be able to share life with, it's great. If social media is where you are getting your approval, it's your drug. Then social media is going to kill you. Tweet that. So, what do we do about these things? Whether they're big or they're small or in the middle, I mean, whatever they are, how do we handle the things that tend to take a grip in our life? Well, 4 realities I want us to look at this morning to take this giant down. Number one is we have to accept that we're all vulnerable. We're all vulnerable. We all have within us the propensity to allow something else to control us, to control our life, and to control our behaviors. Think about that question. What's the one thing that I could not live without? What is it? Just ask yourself. I mean, is it those painkillers that I needed 3 months ago, but now I have to take one every night just to be able to get to sleep at night? Is it you know, that approval that I get on social media? And it's not just that I want to share all my posts with my friends, but I really do like when people like my photos. Is it, you know, a comfort food that I always retreat to? Is it buying things? I mean, what is it? See, when it comes to addictions, we focus on the symptoms, which is what all those are, but rarely do we actually get to the cause. In fact, again, in Goliath Must Fall, they dig deeper into what the cause of our addictions are. Here's what they say. It says, the cause lies under the surface. The root cause of most addiction is pain. The cause is sin. Somebody has rejected us. Somebody has inflicted pain on us. Emotional pain, physical pain, relational pain, economic pain. This person has made us feel like we're not good enough. We're convinced we don't have what it takes, and the sense of inadequacy has been branded on our lives. Our security and sense of significance has been ripped away. Our world was turned upside down, and nothing makes sense or looks clear or feels right. We are lonely or angry or tired or annoyed or frustrated or fearful or betrayed or lost or disgusted or grieving or knocked off kilter. That's the cause. The symptom is whatever addiction shows up and promises to make us feel better. Now see, that is so important to understand right there. That when we feel chaos, when we feel a sense of a loss of control, we gravitate to whatever brings relief. We gravitate toward whatever makes us feel better in the moment. Because we feel like we need to cope somehow. And so we run to whatever we think is going to bring that. And the crazy thing with addiction is it actually does, at least for a short time. We go for the hit, we go for the buzz, we get the adrenaline rush, we get for the quick drug hit. Whatever it is, it masks it for a moment, and we go for the thrill that makes us feel like we're invincible on top of the world, and then the addiction wears off, and we end up lower than we were to start with. And so we have to look beyond the symptom, and we say, okay, what's the cause? What's the pain that's going on under the surface? What's the thing that's causing me to feel inadequate? What's the thing that's causing me to feel like there's chaos going on, and I need to run to something of comfort? Because see, what happens is when we feel vulnerable, that's we naturally become aware of our weakness, and the second thing happens. We begin to cover up and cope. It's the natural human thing. We cover up and cope. In fact, we've been looking at the story of David and Goliath throughout this series, and whether you've been in church, you know, regularly or you haven't, you know, wherever you're on that spectrum, you probably know the story of David and Goliath. And so we get a picture of this from David and his life, and David basically is a teenager at this point. He's not a warrior, but he's bringing supplies to the front line, and he sees this giant of a Philistine, the Philistine army, a guy named Goliath, is down in the valley taunting his people and their army, saying, hey, let's settle this standoff once and for all. And David shows up at the front lines. He's like, why aren't you guys doing anything? You're all warriors, yet you're standing back watching this guy taunt you. So he decides, I'm going to step up, and I'm going to fight the giant. Now understand, David had recently been anointed or identified as the next king of the nation of Israel. He wasn't the next king yet. He was in development mode. King Saul was the next king. So David shows up, and Saul hears him say, hey, I'll fight this giant of a man, Goliath. And here's what Saul says in 1 Samuel 17. He says, you, with a laugh, I'm sure, in the middle of it, you are not able to do this. In essence, you know, Saul looks at David, he's like, David, you're not able to fight this giant. I mean, who do you think you are? And then he goes on to explain why he doesn't think David can do it. He says, you're not able to go out here against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a young man. What he's basically saying is you're not big enough, you're not strong enough, you're not, you know, strapping enough, you don't have any war experience. Who are you to do this? He, though, has been a warrior from his youth. Now, when you first read this, you go, oh my gosh, King Saul's like taking David under his wing, and he's kind of sheltering him and protecting his overambitious young king, you know, protege of a king to not like get his life taken right here with this big giant. But then you begin to realize, I don't think that's the case. I mean, you dig into the story more and you begin to realize that Saul is actually trying to unmask David right here. All right, he's trying to make him feel vulnerable. Now, there's a good vulnerability and a bad vulnerability. You know, there's a natural, healthy vulnerability when we realize I don't have everything I need. I don't have it all together. But then the unhealthy is when someone else tries to make us feel vulnerable, when somebody else tries to belittle us in order to make us feel less than what we are. And so this is what King Saul's doing right here. Now, Saul is like a man's man. He's like a warrior of all warriors. In fact, it says earlier in the Bible that he is a head taller than any other warrior in the Israelite army. So this dude's huge, probably got big, broad shoulders, and he's got the best armor. He's got an accompaniment of warriors with him. In fact, if we're really honest, when Goliath is standing down there taunting the Israelite army, you know, who's going to come fight me? Who's going to end this standoff? Who should have been doing that? Who should have been stepping up to the plate? It should have been Saul. Saul's the biggest warrior. He's the leader of the army. And you know what he's doing? He's hanging out, hiding in his tent, worrying about what's going to happen. So when David steps up, this teenage kid, you know, probably 5'6", 5'8", in stature, he comes and offers, says, hey, I'll fight this beast of a man. Then Saul his first reaction wasn't to, you know, be like, oh, man, this is going to be a hard battle. David, I don't know that you're prepared. What we begin to see is he's trying to save face right here. He's getting shown up by a 14 or 15-year-old boy. And he wants everyone to know that David is going to fail. And yet notice how David responds right here. David says, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. So he basically says, hey, Saul, I'm not trying to, you know, to overpower you as king. It's not my time yet. I'm your servant. I mean, I've just been out watching sheep in my dad's, you know, fields. And then he goes on to talk about the good reason, though, he believes that he has what it takes to fight this warrior. He says, when a lion and a bear came and carried a sheep off from the flock, remember he'd been out watching sheep in the field, I went after it, I struck it, I rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God, the Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion. He's like, hey, I've been in battles with beasts before, and the Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of the Philistine. So David's kind of like, hey, my God, the God I serve, the God I follow, the God I'm intimate with, he's got this. He can totally handle this. He's done it before. He'll do it again. And yet Saul tries to apply his own solution to the situation. So he dresses David up in his armor. And remember, this is huge Saul, who's a head taller than any other warrior. And here's little David. He puts his huge armor on David. He puts the big old bronze helmet on David. He straps a big old sword on David's waist. David can't even stand up under the weight of the armor. He's struggling to stand up, and he's trying to walk around. And in the end, all Saul was doing was trying to cover up what he perceived to be David's inadequacies. And what's fascinating about this is this is what you and I do as well, right? Whenever we don't feel like we have what it takes, what do? We cover up and hide. And for Saul, he was trying to make David feel more protected than he was. He's trying to make him feel stronger than he was. Again, we do this as well, at least I do. When I feel like I'm in a place where I'm a bit vulnerable, my natural tendency is to cover up and make it look that everything's okay. And so David, he gives us a great visual right here. I mean, a great visual. He basically puts aside all of the exterior. He takes the armor off. He takes the helmet off. He puts the sword aside. And he says, I'm just going to go face the giant with me, my slingshot, and my God. And I think the thing that God wants us to see in this story right here, he wants us to get this picture that maybe vulnerability, not feeling like we have everything we need, isn't such a bad posture after all. Because see, whenever we feel vulnerable, what do? We want to run and cover up. That's the crazy thing we do. But David, he doesn't do that. God invites him to run toward him, and he accesses God's power. So David, here's what he says to Saul. He says, I can't go out in these because I'm not used to them. So he takes off all the armor. He took off the false cover. And he walked out to battle, just he, himself, and his relationship with his God. And he defeats the giant. Now, who defeated the giant? Did David defeat the giant? Probably not. It was actually God's power through David that defeated the giant. See, the moment for you and I that we cover up and we hide and we try to show that we're not vulnerable is the moment that God's power gets more and more diminished in our life. See, David, he probably felt vulnerable out there at that moment, but he knew he wasn't alone. And he didn't keep his vulnerability hidden because he realized this giant is way smaller than the power of my God. It says, David said to the Philistine, you come at me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands. Now, there's something really fascinating about this word vulnerable. In fact, I want to put it on the screens right here. If you look at this word, there's another really powerful word, short little word within that word. Take a look at it right here. It's the word able. And one of the things I want us to see is this is a promise right here that when we come to the place and we're able to acknowledge, hey, I'm vulnerable, all right, there's places where I don't have it all together. There's places where I don't have the strength that I need, that it's in that moment when we acknowledge our vulnerability that we become able. This is the third idea today, because God is able. We become able because God is able. See, when we hide our vulnerability, we actually lose God's power. But when we expose our vulnerability, this like opens the door for God's power to be evident in our life. It's this crazy, crazy thing. And so when we think about addictions, even the big ones, as terrible as they may be, you know, one of the helpful things that can come out of them is that they remind us that we can't do it on our own, that we cannot tackle them on our own. And so the fourth reality is we have to fight in packs. We have to fight in packs. In fact, one of the greatest lies of addiction is that I have to handle this by myself. You talk to any addict, they'll be like, oh, this is something I need to resolve. I need to handle this. I've done this. This has been my story. I need to take care of this myself, me, myself, and I. All right, I need to handle this in the privacy of my own life because I don't want anybody to see my vulnerability. But see, it's only when we get vulnerable, not only with God, but with others, that God's power is actually released to begin to address that giant in our life. In John chapter 11, the gospel according to John, we see this great picture of what this looks like with Jesus and one of his good friends. In fact, Jesus had a good friend named Lazarus, and Lazarus had two sisters named Mary and Martha. You may have heard of them before. And Jesus is out traveling. He's about 3 or 4 days away from where Lazarus and Mary and Martha are, and Lazarus becomes sick. And so Mary and Martha send a message to Jesus, and this is the message that they send to him. They say, Jesus, the one whom you love is sick. And so that phrase, they didn't say, hey, Jesus, Lazarus, that one guy you met one time is sick. They said, no, the one you love, which indicates that Jesus was in deep friendship with Lazarus and with Mary and Martha. And so Jesus gets this message. He's 3 or 4 days walk away. And you'd think that he would immediately drop everything and say, oh, my word, we need to go back because that was code. That message was code, was Lazarus is sick and about to die. We need you here right away. But Jesus gets the message. You know what he says? He says, hey, let's stay here a few days longer. Now, the disciples are like, what the heck? Why? What do you mean, Jesus? Why wouldn't we go back? He says, no, let's stay here a few days longer. And so get this. For whatever reason, Jesus waits until his friend Lazarus dies. And then he waits a couple more days, and then he says, okay, now let's go back to Lazarus. And so Jesus, 7 days later, is walking back toward where Lazarus is at. It's about a 3 or 4 days walk. And he arrives at the tomb, and Mary and Martha see Jesus, and they come running to him. And they fall at his feet, and they say something to Jesus that you and I have probably said to God 1,000 times. They say, Jesus, if you just would have been here, if you just would have showed up, our brother wouldn't have died. And Jesus walks over to the grave, and he yells out to the grave from a distance, Lazarus, come out. And Lazarus gets up. Now remember, he's been dead 7 days, all right? Right before this, it says, don't go into the grave because the body stinketh, all right? So, like, he's decomposing already, at least as we understand it. Jesus says, Lazarus, come out. And immediately, we see Lazarus walk out of the grave. And as crazy amazing as that is, one of the things that we see in the story is Lazarus is alive, but he's still not free. See, he had been wrapped in the grave linen, the grave clothes, strips of linen that he'd been wrapped in before he was buried. And so he comes struggling out of the grave, alive, albeit, but not free, still wrapped up. And take a look at what Jesus says in verse 44. He says, take off the grave clothes, meaning the linens, and let him go. Isn't it true that we've come into environments like this probably many times, and we know there's something in our life that has a hold of us that we need to let go of? We need to say, God, I just surrender this. And we have. We've said, God, I promise you, I'm going to let go of this. I'm going to do better this time. I'm going to do different this time. And we have every intention to change. And yet we walk out the doors, and 2 hours later, that idea is going down the toilet with the rest of our lunch. And you're like, well, how can that happen? God, I told you I wanted to change. See, it's not because God isn't present. It's not because God's power doesn't overcome the major giants in our life. It's because the layers of addiction of these kinds of things are still wrapped around us. All right? See, we need other people. We need a pack to take off the layers, to remove the linens so that we can be free. See, the moment you put your trust in Jesus, the moment you say, Jesus, I believe. Jesus, I want to receive your grace. Jesus, I want your power to get rid of this in my life. Immediately, you're in relationship with Christ. But see, you also have to call on other people. That frees you spiritually, but that doesn't mean the linens are taken off because we need other people in our life to take off the linens. We need a pack. And that pack might look like an accountability relationship with a close friend. It might be, you know, contacting a counselor to dig into some deeper history. It might be checking into rehab. But see, until we're ready to find the pack and surround ourselves with an ecosystem of support, that giant's gonna loom large. And so we have to make the decision. Jesus, do I want that power to begin to remove this giant? And then we have to walk out a plan to remove the linens. Now, how do we do that? Well, I want to give you, there's some steps we have to take. I want to give you eight questions today to work through. It's called the responsibility process. And this is a tool I use personally. If there's something in my life I don't like that I want to change, this is something I've used in the office or in my work. If there's something that I don't like that I want to change, it comes from one of my former coaches, Nelson Searcy. It's a great little process. I think he developed it. And so I'm going to give you eight questions. I'm not going to give you time to think through them today, but you can write them down or you can screenshot them here at the end. But these are fascinating. This will create change. If you are saying to God, God, I've got to create some change. I need your power, and then I need to know what to do from here. All right, so eight questions. Here's the first one. What is a difficult or troubling situation in your life? And so whatever that thing is, if you're thinking, man, this is something that needs to change, or this is an addiction that's got a hold on me, there's your thing. All right, there's your answer to the first question. Second question, what payoffs or benefits do you get for keeping it like it is? It's a fascinating question, because even the things we don't like in our lives have a reward. So what is it that I get, or what's the benefit of keeping this like it is? Maybe it's preserving a relationship. Maybe it's preserving face on something. Number three, what cost do I pay, or do you pay, for keeping it like it is? I mean, there's always a cost reward, right? Whenever we think about making a change, I have to weigh the costs with the reward. Fourth question, here's the responsibility part of the process. How do you create, promote, or allow it to be this way? And you might be thinking of a thing, and you're like, well, Kurt, I don't have any control over this. This is something totally from the outside in. Okay, but even something that's from the outside in, you're allowing that to impact your life. You may not be creating it, you may not be promoting it, but you are allowing that to continue to impact your quality of life. In some cases, we may be creating it. In other ways, we may be promoting it. Fifth question, what do you pretend not to know? Another way you could put that is, what are you choosing to ignore? That's a fascinating question, because, you know, that gets to, what are the things that are a part of the situation that I'm choosing not to validate are contributing? Or what are the things I'm choosing to not accept are being affected as a result of this pattern in my life? Sixth question, probably the hardest one on the board. What do you want? It's probably the hardest question to answer. What, as you think about the thing that you want to change, if you think about the cost rewards, what is it that you actually want? Number seven, what actions could you take and what requests could you make to accomplish it? And number eight, when will you do that? So there it is. There's the eight questions. I encourage you to take a screenshot. This is one of our next steps this week. I mean, if you're at the place where you're like, man, there is something in my life I need to change, and I've cried out and I've pleaded with God, said, God, I want this to change. This is your next step. Okay, what are the steps I need to do to begin to walk this out so I can get to a new place? Because see, here's the good news. Jesus has already conquered the giant of addiction. It may be rearing its head. It may be showing up in your life. The grave clothes may still be wrapped around you. But Jesus has overcome the power of addiction. The question is, are you going to go through the tedious process with your pack of identifying what I need to continue to do to allow Jesus and his power to work against this addiction in my life? And it starts with vulnerability. So I want us to think through a few next steps for this week. And for some of us, we may have just come for the first time into the awareness that, man, I'm vulnerable on this front. All right, it's one of the next steps. Maybe your next step this week is just acknowledging that, telling somebody about it. You got a good friend. Hey, I just realized this week I'm connected to this thing. This thing has me hooked. It's like a barbed fish hook. I mean, as much as I try to get it out, it stays in. All right, vulnerability, accepting that's the first step. Maybe it's working through the responsibility process. You've said time and time again, God, I want to change. I promise it's going to be different this time, but things never change. See, God's power is real, but we have to work and partner with God in order for that to happen. So maybe it's sitting down for an hour and working through the responsibility process. Maybe for you this week, it's getting a pack around you. Maybe that's sharing with a friend, you know, developing an accountability relationship. Maybe it's, you know, contacting a counselor. Maybe it's, you know, going to rehab if it's something that rehab can help. Whatever it is, who's going to be your pack? And then next week, I'm really excited as we kick off this series, Spark, because Brent Henderson's going to be here, and I love Brent. Brent was at Man Camp this year, and Brent is a professional outdoorsman. He's a leadership guru, and he's going to be talking about how to take every thought captive, how there's a process that we can work through. This is an idea that changes things, where every thought that comes into your mind, good, bad, or indifferent, you can actually evaluate that thought, and you can call on God to actually help you reframe that so that you don't allow your negative thinking to influence your life. And so if you've been wrestling through, okay, how do I make change in my life this morning? Make sure you're here next weekend. All right, so here's some steps. I mean, we've got to decide, though, when am I going to take the step to begin to not just say I want the change, but I'm going to walk the change out. Now, as you're thinking through those, I want to leave you with one last picture, and comes from the Apostle Paul, and I love the Apostle Paul. He's one of my favorite guys in the Bible, and Paul gives us this powerful picture of dealing with something difficult in our lives, and he does this by first sharing a confession with us, and then and kind of talking about a specific weakness, even though we don't know what it is. So here's what he says. He says, to keep me from becoming conceited, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord. You've probably been here too, where you've pleaded with God. He says, three times I've pleaded with the Lord to take it away, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in your weakness. So here's the picture right here. This is Paul, right? This is the Apostle Paul. He's done amazing things for God. This is the Apostle Paul who used to hate Christians. This is the Apostle Paul who used to try to kill Christians until he became one. And now he's doing amazing things for God. And Paul wrote more than half of the New Testament. He's done amazing things. And yet he says, in order to not become conceited or arrogant, God put a thorn in my side. To which some of us are like, okay, you lost me right there. All right, what do you mean by that? I thought God was about, you know, bringing good and having plans of hope and goodness for a future. He does. He does, all right? And we don't know what the thorn is. Paul doesn't tell us what it is, and theologians have debated this for centuries. Some think it was maybe just a weakness that he had. Others say it was somebody physically hunting him down, trying to kill him. Others say it could have been an addiction of some kind that he just constantly battled. We don't know. But what we do know is it's adversarial. And yet we also know that God allowed it to be there, not to hurt Paul, but to grow him. So Paul goes on. He says, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness so that Christ's power may rest on me. This is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weakness, in insults, in hardship, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I'm weak, then I'm strong. So Paul, get this, Paul wasn't trying to hide his weakness. He wasn't looking to numb every night or to self-medicate so he didn't have to deal with the vulnerability. He says, no, I actually boast in my weakness so that Christ's power will rest on him. Think about this. Anyone who's anyone in the Bible, I mean, as we look back at the key figures in the Bible, anyone who's anyone who's done something great for God, they all walked with a limp. I mean, Noah, Noah had his fair share of, you know, indiscrepancies. Moses, Samson, Solomon, David. Go to the New Testament, you have John, you have Peter who denied Christ, said, oh, Jesus, I'm going to love you forever, and then he turns around and denies him with Paul. I mean, anyone who's anyone, they actually operate out of their vulnerability. This last verse right here, I think it's probably one of the most misunderstood verses in the entire New Testament. Paul says, for when I am weak, then I am strong. You know how you and I usually read that? At least I do. I read that and I take it as, well, God, when I am weak, then you are strong. Which is true. I mean, God is strong when I am weak. But look at what Paul says. He says, for when I am weak, then I am strong. What he's saying is, when I'm willing to accept my vulnerability, when I'm willing to accept that I'm susceptible to such things, that I don't have it all together, and it's okay, that it's only in those moments that God's power really can bring us strength to where I am. And I think that's what God wants for every single one of us. So let's stand and let me pray for us as we think about whatever that thing is, and then we're going to sing one more song. Heavenly Father, we just thank you for giving us these pictures of people who are willing to be vulnerable before you. People who are willing to not cover everything up. I mean, we have a tendency to run and cover. In fact, that's where humanity began, with Adam and Eve running and hiding and covering. So we come by lineage of it. And yet, Father, you've invited us to accept our vulnerability. In fact, you've even said it's when we're vulnerable that you actually can be evidenced the most in our lives. I mean, that's refreshing, at least for me. I mean, I know I don't have it all together, and so many times we feel like we need to have it all together before we come to you, but we begin to see that it's not about getting it together as much as it is acknowledging where I am and allowing you to meet me in that place. And so, Father, there may be some of us here this morning who have never understood you in this way. And maybe our hearts just being strangely warm towards you, and we're ready to begin that relationship. We're ready to invite you into our life, your grace, your goodness into our life. And we realize I don't have to get it all together. I don't have to have everything right. I just come as I am, and you receive me in that way. And for any of us that want to receive that grace and that goodness right now, you can do it by just telling God that. God, I want to receive you. I want to know your grace right now. I want that kind of grace and that kind of power to flow through my life right now. And in that moment, you begin that relationship with Christ and you begin to access the power that can take down giants. And God, for anybody who just made this declaration in their hearts, God, I just pray that you would fill them, that you would guide them, that you would begin to teach them what it means to follow you and to follow your leadings. Father, for others of us who have taken that step, but we've struggled with something that has a hold of us, God, help us to know what to do with what we've heard. Whether it's sitting down and working through the responsibility process or getting a pack around us this week or contacting a counselor or checking into rehab, whatever we need to do, God, I just pray that you would help us to know what to do with what we've heard and that we would follow your leadings this week. And God, thank you for being a God who comes after us, who goes to the dark places and kicks down walls and shows up where we are and that we don't have to earn our way to where you are. And so, God, I just pray that you would remind us of that as we close here this morning.